for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, Senate Democratic leader. Harry Reid says he will not seek re-election. The House and Senate passed budget plans with no support from Democrats. And Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is charged with desertion. Here for the week's top national stories on the Friday News Roundup, Tamara Keith of NPR, Chris Eliza of The Washington Post, and Susan Glasser of Politico. And don't forget, you can watch as well as listen to the program on our live video stream at drshow.org. If you'd like to join us by phone, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Good morning, Diane.
Good to see you. Tamara Keith, what's the word on Harry Reid and why he has decided not to run for re-election?
He's 75 years old. He has been in the Senate for a very long time, a very long-serving leader of Democrats in the Senate. On January 1st, he had an exercise incident where he was using some sort of elastic band and whacked himself in the head, broke some ribs, and has a persistent eye injury that he's still working through. He said that that is not the reason he's planning to retire, but rather that that did give him more time to sort of pause and think about things. And one of the things that he thought about is that if he were to run for re-election in 2016, he would be a top target. The Koch brothers, everybody else would throw a lot of money at him. He'd have to raise a lot of money, spend a lot of money. And that would divert resources away from other Democrats who would be running. And he hopes that Democrats can retake the Senate. There's a real chance that they could. But if all those resources are going to defend him, it would reduce their chances.
Susan Glasser.
Well, the flip side is now Democrats are going to have to spend millions and millions of dollars to keep Harry Reid's seat one way or the other in Nevada. And that will be a very competitive race. Chris can speak better to that than I can. I'm struck by the fact that both Reid has played a crucial role in determining the Senate the way that it has been through the entire course of Barack Obama's presidency. And I think that's really sort of putting bookends on this particular frame and time in which the Senate, always known as sort of where quick ideas go to die, has certainly been not a hotbed of legislative activism. It's become increasingly partisan during the tenure of Harry Reid. Now, Mitch McConnell, of course, is the majority leader. Reid is in the position of trying to see if he can obstruct or keep, you know, his team together as McConnell and his team of Republicans tries to stop Obama from notching any other legislative accomplishments. One quick thing to spotlight, right, is what is the succession struggle inside the Senate going to look like? And I do think that you're going to see a real tug of war inside that Senate Democratic caucus around the liberal side, the Elizabeth Warren progressives versus a more pragmatic kind of get things done.
Interesting. Chris.
Yeah, Susan touches on an interesting point, which is inside baseball, but really important inside baseball, because you're talking about the future leader of Senate Democrats. A decade ago, maybe even 5 years ago, you would have said it's a close race to be the next leader between Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, and Dick Durbin, the senator from Illinois. I would say that race is less close now. Schumer seems to me to be significantly ahead for lots of reasons, one of which is he headed the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee for two election cycles, two very good election cycles for Democrats, and doled out lots and lots and lots of money to them. I do think Susan is right, though. It's fascinating because this wasn't the case 5 years ago when we were talking about Durbin versus Schumer. Schumer is certainly not a moderate or conservative Democrat. I think he would, by most definitions, be a liberal Democrat. At the same time, he is sort of a deal maker, pragmatist, in a way that Elizabeth Warren, Jeff Merkley from Oregon, some of the voices who have been very out, Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island, people have been very outspoken about the need to sort of move the party to the left. He might not be their perfect fit.
He also is, you could say, a Wall Street Democrat. He represents New York. He gets a lot of money from Wall Street. He is certainly one of the Democrats in the Senate who has worked at times for the interests of Wall Street. So that is in direct contrast with sort of the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. I don't know that that will actually affect whether he becomes the minority or majority leader.
A quick note on that. Ironically, right before I walked in, I just looked at my email and I'm already receiving emails from people saying Elizabeth Warren, if she won't run for president, she should run for majority leader.
Wow.
And in truth, she may be the only person. I mean, we talk about how there is this liberal coalition, and there is in the Senate. The issue is, I don't know that they have a champion who could legitimately challenge someone who spent the time that Schumer has spent preparing to get this job. Elizabeth Warren brings a sort of star power. I'm not sure she's interested, but Susan is exactly right. She's the figure that could represent sort of this left in the Senate.
All right. Let's talk about the House passed budget that they passed on Wednesday. The Senate passed one in the wee hours this morning. How significant are these budgets, Susan?
Well, you know, Diane, that's a good question. Even the fact that we're asking the question, how significant is it? Why? Because Republicans have taken over both houses of Congress, and they have promised to show that they can actually get something done and that this year is going to be a return to regular order. Amazingly enough, and it still is amazing, even to me, a longtime watcher of Washington, Congress basically in recent years had stopped doing its basic function of passing budgets and annual appropriations bills. And so it will be a major test of the leadership if they can move this budget season forward in a way that would return us to quote-unquote regular order. This was a first key step in doing that. Last night, the Senate was in session in something, a spectacle called Votorama. You know, dozens and dozens of amendments being added on, many of them almost in sort of a campaign silly season. The anticipation is that you're basically making people vote on amendments that don't really have any significance legislatively, but in anticipation of putting that in a campaign ad against somebody later.
To pin somebody.
That's correct.
On that, Tamara.
Yeah, there's very important symbolism that happens in these Votoramas. And what you end up with is Patty Murray put up a bill related to paid family leave, and you get something like 11 Republicans, mostly up for re-election in 2016, voting in favor of it. So these Votoramas allow you, in the last Votorama, or Votorama two times ago, they voted on the Keystone XL pipeline and discovered that they had a filibuster-proof majority for it. They voted on the medical devices tax and proved that there was a lot of Democratic support for it. So these votes, although completely symbolic, the president does not sign the budget. The budget does not become law. So these votes are purely symbolic, but they show up in ads, and they also sort of prove that certain issues have bipartisan legs at times.
Now, the passage of the budget also triggers a special rule that could affect the future of the Affordable Care Act. Chris?
Yes, Diane, that is true. What you have when you when this law has – let me start again. The law – this is not a – nothing is – as Tamara has pointed out, nothing has happened here. What we have is this will now go to committee. This is – you have the House version. You have the Senate version of the budget.
Sure.
Those will go to committee, a conference committee, and they will attempt to work it out. We don't know if they will or not. We would assume they will. As Susan has pointed out, regular order would suggest that these bills go through the Appropriations Committee, which means each bill governing each of the ways in which the budget is funded, each of the departments, would get the funding through the committee process. This has not happened in the past. It could, but it has not happened in the past.
But
so we'll
Susan,
see.
What happens on the Affordable Care Act?
Well, there's two things right now, you know, sort of hurt. drilling down the track at the same time. One is, of course, actually the Supreme Court's case that they have taken, King versus Burwell, in which basically there is the potential for the Supreme Court to rule, you know, by June or late June or early July in a way that could basically throw 7 to 8 million people off of the rolls. There's a very obscure provision challenged in there. And then on Capitol Hill, you have at the same time the issue of whether they can find a way to use the resolution to block people at the same time.
And this is what's called reconciliation for all the wonks out there. and it's actually how they passed the Affordable Care Act originally, was through this very same sort of obscure, funky budget resolution process called reconciliation. Now, of course, President Obama is still the president of the United States. As long as he's president of the United States, this remains symbolic.
All right, Tan, we'll take a short break here. Tamara Keith is White House correspondent for NPR. Chris Salissa is founder of The Fix. That's a politics blog for The Washington Post. Susan Glasser is editor of Politico. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carbonite, providing secure backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files, from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. And from CA Technologies, who believes that in the application economy, every business is in the software business. CA makes software to empower enterprises and help them thrive. More information is at ca.com.
The Affordable Care Act question, an email from Larry saying, is it true that Ted Cruz is signing up for the Affordable Care coverage? Susan.
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question, actually. Ted Cruz, now, as of this week, our first officially declared 2016 presidential candidate. His wife has taken official leave of absence from her very high-paying job at Goldman Sachs. And so the issue immediately arises about whether what their health care coverage for their family will be. One news outlet reported the other day that that Cruz was going to sign up for the Affordable Care Act. Then his spokespeople immediately kind of walked that back the next day when we went back and asked them, and they said, well, they're looking at it. So there's the possibility that he will do so. But of course, the irony is just too rich, right, of Ted Cruz, who has made his entire career as the opponent of Obamacare, going back to our discussion in the last segment.
Sure.
He single-handedly is responsible for some decent number of those 40 votes or whatever that Congress has held to try to repeal Obamacare. And he shut down the entire government.
And has said he wants to get rid of every single word in the Affordable Care Act.
So he had two giant applause lines in his announcement speech, which was at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia this week. The biggest applause line was talking about Israel and how the United States should be an absolute stern ally of Israel. That was the biggest applause line. The second biggest applause line was, if I'm elected president, actually, I think he probably said when I'm elected president, I will repeal every word of Obamacare. And Susan could not be more right. Without Obamacare, I don't think we have a Ted Cruz presidential bid. It is at the foundation of what made him a national public figure.
And yet, here's a tweet from Joshua who says, am I the only one who truly believes Ted Cruz has a really good shot at winning the nomination? He's like the Republican Obama. Tamara.
Well, there is a lot to unpack in that tweet.
There's only less than 140 characters.
First off, I think there are. I was talking to a senator the other night who is definitely not a Ted Cruz ally, but who said he thinks that you cannot rule out Ted Cruz making it all the way and getting the nomination. If he can make all the other guys look like squishes and really turn out the core base people who are very excited. I've been to events in random places where I went to an event where Ted Cruz wasn't speaking, his dad was speaking, and people took 2-hour-long bus rides to see Ted Cruz's dad speak. That's how fervent people are.
Susan.
Well, I mean, you make a very good, you know, the sort of alternate case. I would say there's no question that that sort of hardcore belief among not just Washington political journalists, but, you know, even Republican activists out there in the land is that Cruz is unelectable, regardless of what they think. We do our weekly insider poll of leading Republican activists in Iowa and New Hampshire. And this week, of 100 of them, not one single person in the Politico caucus thought that Cruz had any chance, meaningful chance of winning it. And I do think that sometimes that the significance of that is that it can become, of course, a self-fulfilling prophecy that if people take a look at him and they say, well, you know, I like his message, but it just isn't going to work. They do tend to move away. My own view is that Cruz is a very interesting figure who could well shape the context in which the Republican primary plays out, but that he is extraordinarily unlikely to win the nomination.
Let's talk about what the House passed yesterday. The Medicare doc fix bill, Chris.
So this is fascinating because I've been on the show many times, and usually what we talk about is how Congress doesn't do anything, right? And how I have said I'm quoting myself, which is ridiculous, but I've said many times that Congress is incapable of doing anything big. This probably doesn't qualify as gigantic, right? It's not immigration reform. It's not, but it's something that has long been called the doc fix. Essentially, it deals with the fees that doctors are charged or receive based on taking patients who are on Medicare.
Right.
What they have done, they being Congress, for a very long time, is essentially patch this. I was saying off air, and I'll say on air, 17 times since 2002. So that's in the last, you know, 12 and a half years. Congress has passed a temporary doc fix, essentially saying, okay, for the next year, we're going to, as I knock my coffee over with my wild gesticulations, for the next year, we're going to not deal with this in any major way. This year, amazingly enough, they dealt with it in a real way. I want to go through the number, Dan. 392 yes votes, 37 no's. So that is
big deal.
Yes, and just very quickly, this is basically what they did. The sustainable growth rate, in Congress they call it the SGR, this is what was funding the doc fix. They have now repealed that. They are now saying that Medicare will increase payments to doctors by a half of 1% each year through 2019, and then after that it will be judged on how doctors perform. In a very small way, it's somewhat remarkable.
It's a big deal.
It is a big deal. It also, as Chris was just starting to say, doctors will ultimately get paid for doing better medicine, not more medicine, which could eventually, given incentives, bend the cost curve a little bit. But here's the thing. Congress did something. They got together. They did something in a big bipartisan fashion. And it is like the most super boring thing that you could do, the SGR. It's this thing that they are just not going to get a lot of credit for outside of, you know, the circles of doctors and people who really care about
it. Okay. Wait a minute.
Sure, yes.
So to help offset the costs, you've got some higher income Medicare beneficiaries are going to be required to pay higher premiums for their coverage of doctor's services and prescription drugs. CBO says this could cost up to $141 billion over 11 years, Susan.
Well, you know, Diane, I'm glad you pointed that out. That actually is the reason where there had been Democratic opposition in the Senate. And in fact, that right now is the biggest remaining obstacle, because while the House did pass this, it now goes to the Senate. This legislation, President Obama said that he'll pass it, but there's still some real arm twisting that needs to be done. It does look like the prospects are much better, of course, than they have been. This big vote, this big overwhelming bipartisan vote in the House helps it. But that cost and that imbalance is part of the reason why Democrats in the Senate had been more reluctant.
All right. Tamara Keith, let's look at the Affordable Care Act. Passed 5 years ago, President Obama signed it. As one journalist summarized it, it hasn't worked as well as many supporters had hoped, but it also has not been a disaster that many critics had predicted.
Well, and in fact, President Obama this week said it worked better than he had expected. So I think that your feelings about the Affordable Care Act depend on where you're coming from. And that has been the case for the last 5 years, and that continues to be the case. But the numbers are that something like 16 million people have private health insurance now who did not have it 5 years ago. There are now 29 states plus the District of Columbia that have expanded Medicaid, sweeping in huge numbers of people who had no ability to afford health insurance before. So if the goal was to insure more people, then it's been pretty successful. If the goal was to insure everybody, it hasn't been very successful. And critics will say, those are great numbers, but that's just because you're forcing me to do it. Many people don't like being told what to do by the government.
What about the out-of-pocket costs and those trends, Susan?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the issues is as Tamara pointed out, it's not just coverage for its own sake. It's what kind of coverage. There's a real issue about what is the nature of some of these health care plans, and therefore how much do people pay? It's people at the lower end of the income scale who are largely, on the one hand, the beneficiaries of Obamacare. On the other hand, if you're getting offered a plan, you know, that basically has an enormous deductible, and you have to pay an enormous amount, how much more medical care do you really have in a practical sense? So that's where those out-of-pocket costs matter. Just one other point, right, which is 5 years is actually already a long time, which is why this Supreme Court case, again, is so important, because part of the strategy, the political strategy of the Obama administration has been to make sure, just to keep the clock running on Obamacare, because there is a sense of historical inevitability. Obviously, that matters also at the Supreme Court. They're very reluctant to overturn something that has become a matter of established expectation and precedent. That really is significant. And I think that had this challenge to the law come in year one or year two, it potentially, you know, would be easier for the justices to rationalize overturning a significant chunk.
The question becomes, Chris, how much of an issue is this going to be in the 2016 campaign?
So, first of all, I wish I knew. I think that, Diane, the Affordable Care Act, politically, when you ask it in terms of public opinion, what do people think of it? And this is a separate conversation from is it working or is it not working? Has essentially become and has been for several years just another way of asking, do you like President Obama or not? In many ways, and if you like President Obama, you feel favorably toward him, you are likely to feel favorably towards Obamacare, and the reverse is also true. So it remains, we were talking about Ted Cruz, it remains a very strong talking point, particularly among Tea Party conservatives. I would say most establishment conservatives, and I'd throw John Boehner in there, recognize that throwing the law out legislatively, is almost totally out. Now, King versus Burwell, the case that Susan mentioned, which has to do with the state markets. Can you set up a state market? If you set one up, are those people eligible for subsidies? If the court rules those people are not eligible for subsidies, I always say that legally could take down the law just because of the amount of money that would be required. But politically, I feel like it's something that matters deeply to both bases. I'm not convinced other folks are that engaged. One point I want to make about the steadiness of the numbers on the Affordable Care Act. Kaiser Family Foundation has asked 54 times this is something of, you know, considerable polling interest. 54 times in the last 5 years, do you have a favorable or unfavorable view of the law? Americans have viewed it more positively than negatively in those 54 times, 8 times. Now, I would say it's usually 43% favorable, 47 or 48% unfavorable. It is set in stone. When the Supreme Court ruled that the law was constitutional a few years back, I thought, oh, okay, now we're going to see some change in public opinion. Nope. Again, because I think it's so tied to what do you think of Barack Obama? If you like Barack Obama and his theory of governance, you like this law. If you don't, you just don't.
Well, and it also turns out that people don't fully understand what Obamacare is. And a lot of things that get blamed on Obamacare are actually just problems with the way insurance works, or misunderstanding of insurance, or this, you know, oh my God, it's such a high copay and I don't understand what it means, or the deductible is thousands of dollars and people think they're actually going to have to pay thousands of dollars when in fact the deductible would only kick in if they were really, really sick. So I think that there continues to be massive misunderstanding, which in part is a result of all of the politics around this.
Tamara Keith of NPR, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of calls, 800-433-8850. First to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi there, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Good morning. I'm calling about the budget and wondering, I've received a couple emails saying about student debt and ability of college kids to get loans, Pell Grants, subsidized loans from the government, is all due to be cut. The number that I saw was $150 billion in cuts in this budget. I'm wondering if that is true, and does that have to, as a parent with three kids, two in college and one on his way, I don't want to see that happen.
Sure.
Mary, let me just reiterate something that both Susan and Tamara have made the point of, which is these votes and these budgets are blueprints. They are not the law. The Republican budget does make significant cuts in lots of places in the House in order to balance the budget by 2024. I don't know the specifics, but I would reiterate to people, because I think it is confusing. This what is happening right now, this is not something that will go to President Obama's desk and he will sign. This is really the two parties outlining their belief system on the right economic way forward for the country.
And what we may get is nothing more than a continuing resolution.
Well, that's right.
May
it's not clear.
Absolutely.
And that's what we've had in the last agreement.
So these budgets are basically a roadmap that Congress then uses for these appropriations bills, the bills that actually spend the money. And when you get down into the nitty-gritty of those, there will be lots of fights, and we could have shutdown threats, but probably not, and all kinds of other stuff. But that's really where the thing that we all think of as a budget, that's where that really happens.
All right. To Gainesville, Florida. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm a longtime listener and I'm a three-time caller.
Thanks.
I'd like to ask the panel about Ted Cruz. I heard the other day on an NPR news report that he was born in Canada.
Correct.
How does he hold American citizenship? Would he naturalize?
Citizen.
Well, he does hold American citizenship. It is an interesting test of the theory that goes right back to the origins of the Constitution, which is, do you have to be by natural born U.S. citizen? Do you have to be born on physical U.S. territory? This was an issue, by the way, with John McCain, another Republican as well, because his father, of course, was in the military and he was born on U.S. territory, but not physically inside the geographic boundaries.
So has the issue been tested?
No. Could be a major lawsuit, actually.
Cruz continues to sort of not address it and just insist he can. But yes, the caller is not unique in suggesting that this could be an issue. Yes.
All right. Short break here. And when we come back, more of your calls, your questions. We also want to talk about Bo Bergdahl and what's happening in Philadelphia. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Emma, email marketing and automation software featuring specialized editions for organizations like universities, agencies, and franchises. Emma, email marketing for the modern brand. Learn more at myemma.com. From Arizona State University, with more than 70 campus degrees to choose from, offered 100% online with 6 start dates a year. Learn more at online.asu.edu. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the International Hour, the Friday News Roundup, an update on the plane crash in the French Alps, Saudi Arabia launches airstrikes against Yemen rebel bases, and President Obama slows U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we must have had at least a dozen questions about Ted Cruz and his citizenship. Tamara, you wanted to bring in something.
Yeah, so he was born in Canada, but his mother is an American citizen. His father was from Cuba. And his father had a job in Canada in the oil sands, I think. And so his mother, being an American, if you're an American and you have a child overseas, you can file paperwork to make sure that your child is an American. About sometime in mid-2013, Ted Cruz actually renounced his Canadian citizenship, perhaps
in
anticipating
preparation for running for president.
What was happening right
so
now.
So he was a dual citizen.
He was a dual citizen, and now he is purely an American citizen. And there will be people who say, well, find that paperwork that his mom filed and make sure she filed it on time. And presumably someone will be calling for him to release his State Department documents.
All right, let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a short comment, but I'd like to hear what your panel will say, and I'll get off after I say this. I think the only thing that Ted Cruz winning the Republican nomination will do is guarantee a Democrat is the next president.
What do you think, Susan?
I think Hillary Clinton would be certainly quite happy were Ted Cruz to win the Republican nomination.
Do you all feel the same way?
He has a very, unless he demonstrates an ability that he has shown neither the willingness nor the ability to demonstrate, which is to move beyond people who are extremely against President Obama and extremely conservative, it is very hard to see someone like him putting together a majority coalition as the nominee.
Tamara.
He is not a coalition builder. That hasn't really been his MO. So certainly it's hard to see that path right now.
Okay. And here's an email from Dean. How would you handicap Congress being able to find a permanent solution to the next doc fix, which is the yearly bailout of the Highway Trust Fund?
It shouldn't be yearly, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Well, this is a good example of how even things that used to be non-controversial, nonpartisan in Congress have become partisan and almost mystifying. Infrastructure, highways, that used to be the most old-fashioned sort of pork barrel, I give you this, you give me that committee in Congress. It used to be absolutely non-controversial. Now we're sitting around, there's an urgently needed highway bill and infrastructure upgrades and real questions as to whether it will happen. So my narrow answer on that is I'm actually still quite skeptical, even though, of course, it's what's so interesting about that doc fix is that it seems to be the kind of technocratic solution that you would think there would be a large majority for. But remember that Obamacare, before it had this very political name to it, was perceived as a more or less technocratic fix when it was the Massachusetts Mitt Romney version. And I think if anything, it's Obamacare has proven that you can take a technocratic, the experts agree on it kind of legislative proposal and even turn that into a partisan thing. So highways can be partisan too, unfortunately.
Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Hi there, Catherine.
Hello, can you hear me? This is
sure
Catherine.
Can. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to ask a question about the Affordable Care Act and Ted Cruz. I have been in the marketplace for 2 years now and had insurance on my own before that. So if he repeals it, what is he putting in place? Because for people like me, I work seasonally. Before, there was nothing available for me as a seasonal employee. I take care of my mom. My dad just passed Sunday, and I need to be available for them. Yeah. I hire people to help me, and I can't help them get insurance. I pay them, and hopefully they can go through the Affordable Care Act, the marketplace, to get insurance. So what is in place when that is repealed for people like me?
And that is the fundamental problem for the Ted Cruzes of the world, and frankly, why you don't see John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and other, for lack of a better word, establishment leaders saying we're going to repeal this whole law anymore, which they did say during parts of the last campaign. The reason for that is, Susan mentioned this earlier, it's important. This is a massive piece of legislation, both in terms of its size, which Republicans made a big deal out of, but also in terms of its scope. It has been 5 years. You heard this woman saying she's been on the marketplace for 2 years without something equally large and comprehensive, which, by the way, given what we saw, how difficult it was to get the Affordable Care Act through, this would not be something that would just cruise right through Congress.
So
I think politically,
in short,
at the presidential level, Ted Cruz does not have a full replacement plan. Let me answer
it
that way.
Yet.
Not yet. Now, will he?
Who knows?
He might.
There are some discussions of allowing people to purchase insurance across state lines. None of the Republicans are saying, I mean, they are saying that they want to repeal it whole cloth, but in the next breath, they will say that they want to allow people with pre-existing conditions to continue to get insurance. They want to allow kids to stay on their plans. All the things that are popular, Republican lawmakers have made clear that they don't actually really want to get rid of those things. But in terms of coming up with something that would be fully functioning and a full replacement for the ACA, that has not been formulated.
All right, let's talk about Bo Bergdahl. Susan, the Army has charged Sergeant Bo Bergdahl with desertion. Talk about the charge, what it means.
Well, remember, this is the young American soldier in Afghanistan who at the time that it was recounted that he wandered off his base in Afghanistan, he was captured, eventually held by the Taliban. We eventually negotiated a swap for his release. The
Five.
Problem. Well, that's right. And Taliban ranging from foot soldiers to actual officials were released as part of the trade. The problem, the political problem, is that President Obama sort of got out in front of the facts here and, appeared in the Rose Garden with Bergdahl's parents, celebrated him as having been sort of a brave soldier who had been captured and held for a very long time in captivity. Now we have the postscript. Even at the time, there was a lot of outrage about Obama's statements. His fellow soldiers who had served with him were convinced that he had, in fact, deserted, that he had on purpose left the base. He left his weapon behind. There was a lot of, there was a diary. There was a lot of evidence to suggest that he had become a doubter, that he had was not convinced that the American presence in Afghanistan was the morally right thing to do. He's now his attorneys are trying to portray Bergdahl not as a deserter, but as a conscientious objector, basically as a whistleblower on the bad conditions in Afghanistan. But one way or the other, I think it's somewhat of an embarrassment for President Obama. The best I saw that sort of Obama supporters could muster on Twitter yesterday was, okay, fine, but let's charge him in our system and not leave him to rot in a sort of Taliban captivity. I think, Americans are fair-minded. Probably a lot of people agree with that. But still, it's a bit of an embarrassment.
What's likely to happen going forward?
The next step is what amounts to the military version of a grand jury. And then potentially a court-martial and trial. He faces up to life in prison. And so he will get a fair trial through the justice system, through the military justice system. He released a letter through his lawyer where he discussed the conditions that he was under in captivity with the Taliban and the Haqqani network. And it sounds rather unpleasant.
He was there. He was held for how long?
For 5 years. He says he tried to escape a dozen times. He was held much of that time in a room where he couldn't see out, where the light changed. I mean, it sounds absolutely terrible. But President Obama, the criticism is President Obama made a trade without consulting Congress first. And that is problematic, and people are saying, you did that for this guy?
Yeah. So has the White House commented as yet?
Not that I have seen. And one thing to point out, Diane, Susan mentioned the sort of political implications. Yesterday, the House Government Reform and Oversight panel sent a letter to the White House requesting, I'm going to quote here, all intelligence reports and assessments, end quote, about Bergdahl's disappearance and capture. So this is not going away, politically speaking, anytime soon. I think the charges of desertion and what's called misbehavior before the enemy are a step in the legal process, but we are seeing this going to continue to play out.
All right, to John in Houston, Texas, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thank you. As a Marine Corps infantryman, I served in the Second Battle of Fallujah in 2004. And I find it very discouraging that we've got honorable veterans who have wandered across the Mexican border, and our administration on the service makes no attempt to help those individuals, yet will use us as political pawns and trade one person who is rumored to have been a deserter for five enemy combatants.
I'm not sure what the caller is referring to specifically about the Mexican border, but I do think it is a politically resonant precedent point, which is why Republicans in Congress will emphasize it. I do want to make one point, though, which is it is actually fully within Obama's rights to make an agreement, a trade like this, without consulting or having any kind of permission from Congress. Politically speaking, there's a real question around the advisability of doing this, although one could imagine that it would might not be as easy of a line, but that it would also, you know, Americans are fair-minded people, and my guess is that they'd even prefer an American deserter to be tried in the American military justice system rather than rotting in captivity.
And talk about reversal. Charlottesville police announced they found no evidence to support a gang rape at the Phi Kappa Psi. What did they say, Susan?
Well, I mean, this is a very tragic story, right, in many ways. This, of course, is the Rolling Stone account that gripped people, that pretty quickly collapsed when people started to actually look into it. You know, the most damning thing, right, is that there wasn't even a party on the alleged night in question when this...
At least not one that can be verified.
Right, at this particular fraternity that was alleged. Now, the next stage, and so we now have this police report. The next thing that will happen is that Steve Call, the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, has just turned in this week. We haven't seen it yet. What I'm told is a 12,000-word examination. My guess is it will be quite devastating of the Rolling Stones handling of it. It's a terrible journalism story in many ways. Of course, I think it's been very destructive and very upsetting to the community of people who cares about doing something about sexual violence against women. It unfortunately dominates the conversation in a way that is probably very unhelpful. And it's just a personal set of personal tragedies as well.
But, you know, the larger question remains about what happens on college campuses. And I think presidents of universities all over the country are going to be thinking very, very hard about the Greek societies, about alcohol, about partying, and all the rest of it. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hey, hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi. You know, there's so many ways to look at the Obamacare argument, but to say it simply, what's wrong with having more healthy people in America? I call that a good thing.
Good question. What do you think, Tamara?
That's not the kind of good. Of course, it's good to have more healthy people in America. Also, presumably, if people are getting more preventive care, they are spending less money
key.
In emergency rooms, and hospitals have seen a reduction in sort of unpaid care that they've been forced to administer to people who need it.
You know, there's one final story. The Department of Justice has provided Philadelphia police with 91 recommendations on ways to improve. What do you think of that?
This is interesting. This report comes 3 weeks after the Department of Justice's – three-ish weeks after the Department of Justice's report on Ferguson, obviously creating a lot of comparisons. There are many differences. The critical difference – I think is this was a process requested by Charles Ramsey, who will be familiar to many people in Washington. He's a former D.C. police commissioner, is now the Philadelphia police commissioner.
Right.
There had been concerns about the level of police-involved shootings, despite the fact that the crime rate had been dropping in Philadelphia. And Charles Ramsey asked the Department of Justice to look into it. The report is not terribly flattering to the Philadelphia Police Department. 400 civilian shootings over the last 7 years. 59 unarmed people were shot fatally. I want to quote, I've got a few quotes here that I think are important. This is from the Department of Justice report. Officers are trained inconsistently on the department's use of force policies. There is another quote, there's an undercurrent of significant strife between the community and the police. So it is an easy and too easy comparison of this to Ferguson, but I would say the attention on Ferguson has done, I think, is drawn a lot of police departments to say, how are we interacting with the community?
Exactly.
Let's not have a situation like what happened in Ferguson be the catalyst for us to look into it? Let's start looking into it before.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, the numbers are striking because it's not even just the raw number of incidents. It's that they are higher than cities that have a significantly larger population. So Philadelphia, is an outlier just by the numbers alone. I am struck, as you said, Chris, by the resurgence of a real, and I think it's important, new scrutiny of the ways in which race is clearly affecting how our police forces act. These statistics are no news to anyone who was paying attention. The problem was that we weren't having a sustained and critical look at both what's causing these numbers. There's nothing new about the numbers. It's the fact that it's reaching broader attention. If you talk to the African-American community 5 years ago, they would have said this is one of their top issues. It's just that we wouldn't have been talking about
Tamara.
It.
This is basically one more data point in this ongoing national discussion about just the massive distrust that exists between communities of color in particular and police forces. And it's in many cities, in many places, it is a toxic relationship, which doesn't make anyone safer.
Let's hope that these kinds of reports will help to improve the situation. Thank you all. Tamara Keith, Chris Saleza, Susan Glasser. Have a great weekend.
You too, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.